And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
It's somewhat classic. Flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. Well, we had a little bit of technical difficulties. We got through it, and the show is on. So tonight's guests, we have two of them, is John Sumple and Jack Roth. They have a film out about abduction. And, you know, if you're a longtime listener, you know that I've been kind of on the fence about that whole situation. It's a pretty compelling film. I did watch it. It's called Extraordinary of the Seeding. And it's coming out on September 3rd, coming right up. And we're going to be talking about that, and also a whole bunch of other things. I'm sure we're going to touch on before them. I do have Alejandro Rojas coming up with UFO updates, and so there's a lot going on in the news. We'll be talking about that. I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show, and anyone can do that. All you have to do is go over to podcastufo.com and check out how to help us out over there. Also, I forgot to mention last week, we have a blog up on Dr. James McDonald and the UFO problem. That's the name of it, by Charles Lear. A very well-written article. Check that out. That's also over at podcastufo.com. We also have a Facebook site, Twitter, and all that stuff that we're supposed to have. But anyway, that's enough talking for me. Alejandro, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Yes, as always, Alejandro, as always, we have a lot of fun. So we're coming right up in just a couple of weeks. I will see you out in Phoenix. I'm really excited
yes.
about that. Yeah.
Yes. And unfortunately, not both of your guests will be there, but Jack will be there. But John will be there in spirit because they both have a film in the film festival. The one you just mentioned, you'll be talking about here. And so good luck to those guys. And it's a, you know, you saw it. It's a very, very well done film with a lot of, in fact, some of our other speakers are in there, including Richard Dolan, Chase Kletsky. I think Melinda Leslie's in it, who's going to be at the conference as a vendor. So, yeah, it's kind of a cool thing because it's a lot of the people that you know and will see there at the conference. Mm-hmm. So there's stiff competition when it comes to the films. Jeremy Corbell has his two films in there. Many of you are probably familiar with Tim Crawford from UFO TV. He's got a couple films. Mm. Now, he's sponsored films before, but these are the first he's like really directed and produced himself. But they're very well done. So there's going to be some really tough competition there for J3. But they've been winning film festivals all over the country.
That's
so
right.
By now, they're used to winning. So for them, their winning streak continues.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is happening in general? What's going on?
In general, well, not. I wasn't going to talk about a general. Actually, I was going to talk about an admiral. This is something
segue.
I wrote for the Roswell Daily Record recently. However, I have more pictures if you go to my blog, AlejandroTRojas.com, and see it there and links and stuff. But essentially, Brian Bender was at the Aspen Security Forum a couple weeks ago while many of us were at MUFON, actually. And this is a really important forum at the Aspen Institute with, you know, all of the top level officials when it comes to defense, defense contractors, defense writers, and many people in the military. And in one of those forums, Bender was actually going to be there to moderate. Of course, he's a guy who is also in an unidentified, and he's broken some UFO stories recently, including the fact that the Navy was rewriting their UFO guidelines, reporting guidelines. Well, in one of the forums, unrelated about China and defense issues related to China, Admiral Davidson, who's in charge of the Indo-Pacific Command, so a big portion of the Navy, was asked by one of the guests about UFOs. The guy was embarrassed when he got up and asked, and he kind of stumbled through the question. He didn't really even get the whole question out. You know, he was just asking about UFOs. The crowd unfortunately laughed, but Admiral Davidson didn't. And he said, yes, you know, we've got new reporting guidelines for UFOs. And he also added this. He said, I want to note that, you know, this only happened during a finite period, these sightings that had been reported. And that was about all he said. So what I was curious about and what I analyzed was that comment. What did he mean by a finite period of time? Brian Bender, I asked him, and he said he thinks that what this guy meant is that they're not happening constantly everywhere all the time, that they're just happening in these short periods of time. No doubt that's probably accurate. Of course, we've heard from unidentified over a couple cases, 2004 outside of San Diego and then 2014 and 15 outside of Florida. But so he's saying, you know, even if there are other cases, they're kind of one-off type situations, not like they're just contending with these things all of the time. And from the witnesses we've heard from, you've had several on, or you've had at least Kevin Day on, so have I, you know, this wasn't something that happened regular. So that's why it was so important when it did happen to them and they did get, you know, confront these unknown objects. But Tyler Rogaway has been writing about this, and I asked him about it also. He's a defense writer. You've had him on the show for The Drive. And he says that he agrees that it's accurate. They're finite periods of time. And he's been honing in that in both of these incidents in 2014 and 2004, that there was new radar technology that was deployed in both of those instances when they started seeing things. And that could be a factor that leads to the possibility of a human origins for these things. The problem with that, as he admits, is the technology and the characteristics that were displayed by these objects is beyond what we have right now. It's definitely a technology that it defeats the physics as we know it currently. And he admits that that makes that harder to understand what these are. But, you know, in his defense, to people who would probably criticize him, to say, oh, you know, if it's beyond what we can do, how can it be human? We don't know yet. And this is how you investigate. And it's great. I love what Tyler is doing personally. And what the Navy said on honing in on this being a finite, you know, period of time may give us some insight into the Navy's thinking. At least the Admiral may have been briefed on investigations where that is a factor. They're looking at similar factors that Tyler Rogaway is looking at to try to determine if there is indeed, you know, a foreign government that has had some sort of technological breakthrough. And of course, if that's true, that would be a big deal. That was something that, you know, somebody, one of the lawmakers recently, what Mike Walker, you know, he wrote a letter to the Navy wanting to know more, and he highlighted that same issue. So a lot still going on in Washington and with the, you know, military around UFOs publicly. So it's still a hot topic out there. Another hot topic.
Wait, just a second, if we could, before we move on from that. I just, you know, I'm wondering, you know, we have, you and I have talked about this before. We have seen these characteristics, or people have noted these characteristics of these vehicles, you know, long, long ago, you know, way, way back.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking it's more to do with what you mentioned earlier, our new technology. Perhaps they're always there. Perhaps they've always been there off and on, you know, finite, like the Admiral said. But perhaps we can only just begin to see them, you know. And anyway, I think a lot of it has to do with our technology.
I think that is another great possibility. In fact, I talked to a guy I knew, an older gentleman in Colorado, And right now his name eludes me, Franklin Carter. Great guy. He actually took over a UFO conference in Cheyenne, Wyoming. But he was in the Navy way back during the Dew Line, during the Cold War, where they were part of the ships that would watch for anything coming. They would, you know, go right up to the water there, up against to where they can, closest to Russia as possible, to monitor what Russia is up to. when they instituted a new radar system that he was in charge of, he was the radar tech, this happened. They started seeing things way up in the sky. They were reporting them. And eventually, you know, every time they saw something like this that would go thousands of miles per hour or something, they would call up Franklin and say, hey, Carter, you know, we got another problem with the radar. Come check this out. And he would verify that there wasn't, you know, a problem with the radar. In fact, when they would get these, they started calling him Carter's contacts. They'd be like, Carter, we got another one. And he would come check it out.
Wow.
Well, they had technicians and everything come. Finally, he asked some of the other radar techs and some of the other ships, hey, you guys have this new radar. Aren't you guys seeing this stuff too? And they said, yeah, but we're not going to report it. It's too much of a headache. People make fun of you. You know, there's all this paperwork and bureaucracy. And so they wouldn't report it at all, which is something that, you know, we hear quite often from people in the military. So there's two reasons that's important. One, it speaks to your theory or your idea that perhaps we're just seeing more and that they're staying out of our radar. And once we increase our radar capabilities, then we can spot them and then maybe they move away further or something like that. That's, I think, a valid point. The second thing, though, is why it's so important that the Navy said they have UFO reporting guidelines and take it seriously. Those, you know, people in there laughed. Tyler Rogaway even said that was disgusting, that some of his colleagues would laugh at this question. But that's kind of the reaction that people have. And I think that's the importance of the Navy saying this is important and we want to hear from UFO reports to say that they're taking it seriously. It's not a laughing matter. It is something serious. I think that's the main function of the rollout of these reports, because no doubt we already know they already have reporting systems and processes for important things like this. So I don't know that that's becoming more robust, but it's more of a message that, hey, we are taking this more seriously. Do send those reports along. But I think you have a good thought there. Yeah. I was talking about hot in the desert, not just here in Phoenix, but in the desert near Area 51, mm-hmm. where millions of people are threatening to gather in a few weeks here on September 20th. Well, just yesterday, Lincoln County said that they are going ahead with plans to declare an emergency due to this at Storm Area 51 thing. Now, they also, interestingly enough, released some permits to some of the events because people are taking advantage and they're holding concerts mm-hmm. and campouts and parties out there. So there's a lot of that sort of thing going on, and that's what these guys are preparing for. A lot of times when emergency declarations are made, it frees up emergency funds, and they probably need these funds, hopefully to keep people safe. This is a desert. There's no gas anywhere around there. There's no water. There's only a couple small little places that don't have a lot of facilities. So I'm imagining that they're going to try to make sure and provide facilities, also have security and emergency personnel, a lot of first responders ready for whatever may happen. Now, hopefully it's just an innocent party, maybe even some talks about UFOs. I'm actually in talks with someone who asked me, hey, do I want to come out there and, you know, talk about UFOs during this whole thing? And I may, but of course, I don't want anybody to pass the gates. And that's kind of the theme of all these parties. Don't pass the gates, but let's party, some of them are thinking, and make money. Whereas others are activists and are thinking, well, let's highlight. Let's say, hey, we think this is important. We want to know more about this topic and make that kind of the whole thing as opposed to trying to do anything illegal.
I would imagine, I know we're out of time here for the news, but I would imagine that they're going to be very prepared for something to happen.
Yeah.
I'm not saying Rachel, but I'm going to say Area 51. I believe that they'll probably be ready for something.
Yeah, this is Lincoln County in particular that asked for the emergency declaration. So I think, it's going to be more at a county level. And mm-hmm. no doubt there is some sort of base involvement as well.
Right. Alejandro, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great show.
All right. I sure will. You bet.
Good.
Talk to you next week.
See ya.
All right, everyone. The guests we have tonight, they are part of J3 Films that was formed back in 2001. And they have extensive ties to the ufology and paranormal fields. We're going to talk to them about their previous film, the Stan Romanek story as well. And anyway, their new film, The Seeding, is getting a lot of exposure, and as Alejandro mentioned, is winning a number of awards. So we're going to be talking about the whole thing. All right. So welcome to the show, Jack and John.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yes, this is great that you two could both be on. I do appreciate that. And I know you must be very, very busy right now because it's just coming right up. You're, what is it? Is it 2 weeks? Your show premieres, right?
2 weeks from today.
And where does it premiere?
It's going to be available on every digital download pay-per-view platform. So the iTunes, Google Play, Amazon Video, and Xbox platforms, and PlayStation, Vudu, Vimeo. So
wow.
If you're watching video or listening to music on a platform, chances are pretty good it'll be on there.
All right. And that was the voice of John Semple. And Jack, you two got together, and did one of you have more of an interest in UFOs and that topic than the other? How did this all happen?
Well, initially, yes. I had already kind of been down the rabbit hole, and this is going back. Oh boy, we can go way back, but let's start maybe 10 years ago. We were talking about doing a documentary, and I was already fairly familiar with the ufology landscape, and I had a couple ideas. We need to do something really compelling, really, really cool. We need to find a cool story. And John was coming at it. So we're filmmakers, but I had that interest in the topic, and it worked out well because when we decided on the story we were going to tell, which was our first documentary, the one we did, Extraordinary, the Stan Romanek story, we knew we found the great story. But it's great because John came at it more from, okay, I'm gonna step back and be learn as I go along with all of this stuff that we're finding out and we're discovering, and keep that filmmaker kind of distance and objectivity. And I was able to do that too, but I was also able to offer a lot of information as far as, look, this is what's going on, and as far as ufology is concerned, this is what's been happening for the last 70 years. So it was a really kind of good combo for us because we're able to maintain that filmmaking kind of stance and be objective in the way we're telling the stories. But there's also there's an understanding of the topic that we're delving into.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Now, Stan was the fourth guest on my show here. Boy, we're going back just about 8 years, close to 8 years ago. And I know there's a lot of controversy in all different types of ways with Stan. Of course, he was found guilty of. And the timing worked just about the same time that I saw your film go up on Netflix. Was the timing about the same time?
Yeah, it was a very interesting journey, to say the least. We premiered the film at the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival in November of 2013. In January of 2014 is when Stan had his legal issues, as well as just I think January was the interview with Peter Slattery. That had flipping pen cap. Mm-hmm. And then a month later was the announcement that he had been arrested. So those things couldn't have come at a worse time for us.
I
because
bet.
We were we were in the process of talking with distribution opportunities for the film. And once all that happened, it was those conversations ended. The only way that they would be interested is if we recut the film and focused on his current situation. And we're like, well, no, this film is about a time in his life from 2000 to 2010. That's what we focus on. That's the timeline in the film. So we kind of said, we're going to stick to our guns. We're going to release it as it is, but we did the independent route and we created a website, altpov.tv, and self-distributed the film there. Fast forward 3 years, 2017, January of 2017, we get a phone call from The Orchard out of the blue saying, we're interested in repping your film. So it was released initially the same way on digital platforms, and then they sent a screener copy to Netflix executives, and they didn't even have to pitch it. They looked at it and they were like, yep, we love the evidence in the beginning, you know, done deal. We'll have it on Netflix in a few months. So that timing was, I think, sometimes I say it was a coincidence, and other times I'll say, well, there's no coincidences. But
yeah.
We weren't reaching out to anybody. We made no effort to try to connect to a distribution opportunity. Our only thing was that we knew that there were people who invested, and those people who had invested in the film needed to make their money back.
Right.
It was more of a loan than an investment, not an investor situation. But we had notes that we owed people money for. And once that opportunity presented itself, we were like, yeah, sure, we'll distribute the film. Just the timing of it happened to be when the Netflix drop was right at the time of the crescendo of his court dates. So right. That was drew a lot of attention to his case and the film, and detrimentally so to the film, because a lot of people went into attack mode based on the event on YouTube, and also the legal issues, which we completely understand and don't blame anybody for reacting the way that they did.
Well, I understand. Yeah, I do get all that. And one thing I would have to say about Stan, you know, he there's no reason for him to have embellished the way he did. You talked about Slatterly when he was on that show, because everyone that I've talked to that has known Stan, had known him in the beginning, said, you know, things do actually happen around him. And these are people that, you know, I hesitate to say their names on air, but these are people that are serious in the UFO topic that have experienced weird things. You know, it is unfortunate. His legal situation is very unfortunate. And I think, I would have to say you were extremely lucky, in my opinion, to have that break and be able to hopefully recoup your money back on that. Overall, what made you decide to move on and create this other film?
Well, I would say the one thing that we learned from making the first one was that there are a lot of stories out there. There are a lot of people who've had experiences that they felt like seeing the film and the fact that it was getting the kind of attention that it was helped them realize that they, you know, their experiences were similar and that they weren't crazy. And we received, it was over 700 messages on our Facebook page alone, and dozens more through email, with people saying, thank you so much for getting this film out there. I know I'm not crazy. I've had similar things happen to me. So that was really an interesting point for us, because initially we weren't all in on making another ufology film. And that realizing that there was a humanity element to this, where people were being affected by their experiences and mostly shunned by general society for those experiences, we felt that we had a chance to do more work, tell more stories, and add a more humanistic storytelling approach to it that brought these stories to the masses, as opposed to targeting a group of people, a demographic that already believes. So our approach in the second film was to introduce fresh faces with the people who have had experiences. The three principal people had not had their stories very well known when we first started, although one of them has turned into a little bit of a rock star over the last year, and Geraldine Orozco. Her story is out. She's leading a lot of people through discussions and trying to help them with their experiences, and we can get into that a little bit more. But when we started making the film, we realized throughout the course of production that we had a different story to tell, and I had an epiphany during it that this was not about phenomena. This was about the people. So we needed to move forward with a story that connected people to people, as opposed to just focus on the events, the lights in the sky, the evidence. We wanted to tell a more human story.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. Now, as I mentioned in the beginning of this, I have been kind of on the fence about, abductions, but then I've also kind of corrected my thoughts, my personal thoughts about that in such a way to look at it this way. I do believe in certain cases, and if I believe in those certain cases, like, for instance, the Betty and Barney Hill case, Travis Walton, who I've talked to a number of times face-to-face, and then there's several, the Allagash incident, there's several of them that are just too compelling for me to say, no, that couldn't happen. The Pascagoula case is another one. So I do believe that if whoever it is, and I'm not saying aliens, I never like to say aliens, but whatever it is visiting us here from wherever they're visiting us from, you know, they're going to be not just landing and going away. You know, they're going to be looking at the biology here. And, you know, there's so many things that could be related to this. Cattle mutilations is interesting. And, you know, there's just a lot of things that are possibilities of whoever these visitors are, you know, could be possibly doing. Where I get a little, I kind of get blurry eyed is when it gets into the reptilians. And, you know, I know that was part of your film and the thoughts, and then the seeding, the actual, you know, the main part of your show, you know, the hybrid children. But I want to talk, I mean, that's hard to swallow. And I think it's hard to swallow for anyone who's not involved in this. And so I want to start out by saying, how did you vet the people in your movie?
Well, we spoke to dozens of people, and we had long conversations with them, and you know, they told us their stories, and a lot of them wanted to share their stories, but there were some who were afraid to. They were tentative about it because they were, depending on what their situation was, whether a relationship situation, were married, they have kids, they're part of involved in the community, could have been a professional reason, because this is a social taboo, they told us their story, but they didn't want to go on film. One of the things you mentioned, though, Martin, that's really important to understand is that that's one of the reasons why it is very difficult to swallow the idea of hybrid children and this kind of hybridization programs being done by ETs as part of the abduction process, of the abduction phenomena. But what we've tried to do is lead people down a path and start at the very beginning and start with, okay, look, here is this one man, Stan Romanek, who's seeing strange lights in the sky. And then all of a sudden he's seeing daylight craft, and there's groups of people that are seeing it with him. So I think once people understand that, okay, I can wrap my head around, and I went through the same process you did, I can now wrap my head around. I always believed that there was life on other planets, that there were extraterrestrial life forms. And then I pretty much objectively kind of started to – I was pretty sure that they somehow could get here, that they have visited and, you know, depending on their technology. But then now it gets a little trickier because now it starts to hit home. It starts to get real, almost a little unnerving, because now when we're talking about abductions, we're talking about something very personal. It's an invasion of privacy. It's an invasion of our space and what's going on. But I think that when we're trying to lead people from A to B, C, D, and not go directly to M or Z, which would be, you know, where we're going with this is, are there hybridization programs that are ongoing and have been ongoing for decades, wherein people, men and women, have been abducted, have been experimented on, have been used for reproductive purposes, and the end result of that is hybrid children. And it's kind of like, well, why might that be the case? So when you say I can't wrap my head around that, that's really something that's totally understandable, because most people who are still wrapping their heads around, are UFOs even real? Are ETs even out there? Well, then it's going to be harder to understand or accept that these hybridization programs are occurring.
Right. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that, John?
No, it's a journey, I think, an awakening, a discovery of possibilities. And we've said this numerous times before, is we're not going out there saying that what we're documenting is fact. We're telling stories. And what we're doing is finding stories that corroborate a pathway that has been shared by many people who have had the same stories before. There's documented evidence of people who have shared their abduction story that live in remote areas that don't have access to the internet, television, even electricity. But when they share their stories, they corroborate with people who have shared their stories. So when you start to see evidence, let's say evidence, and we had a discussion with Dr. David Jacobs about this, and he said, I'm sick and tired of people saying that there is no evidence. We've got tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who have had stories, shared experiences, have had abduction process stories that they've shared that are very similar. They're corroborating each other. At some point, we have to acknowledge the fact that this very well may be the evidence that we should be looking at. So we're just trying to present the information in a way that allows people to analyze it in a digestible way, like Jack was saying, is that we're not going to take them into the deep dive at step one. So the three films that we're making are trying to get people to watch them in sequence and say, okay, now I have a better understanding of the big picture, as opposed to just diving into the minutia, which is what a lot of films do. So our objective from the very beginning was to reach the widest audience possible. And in order to do that, we need to share stories that were not super over the top, but would also connect with people. And one of the ways this film connects with people is from an emotional standpoint. So I've talked with people from a scientific point of view that there's no empirical evidence to prove this, and they're exactly right. There isn't. But there's a lot of stories of people sharing something that happened to them where they had a profound impact emotionally, psychologically, in some cases intellectually. So we can't deny that people who have had these experiences, whatever they may be, that they had them. And that's one of the issues I think that we have, is that so many people are denying that these things exist and that these experiences are real, when the individuals that have been through them have done nothing more than tell their side of the story. And they're not looking for fame or fortune. And anybody who knows the ufology world will know that that's not doable. Mm-hmm. For anybody who goes out and shares their story, what they're doing basically is opening themselves up to a tremendous amount of ridicule. Mm-hmm. So our objective really was to let's guide people through a process, though, so that at the end of each film that we've made, ask yourself one simple question. What if this is true? The what if part. So if it is true, what does that mean? So we're trying to encourage a discussion that asks the age-old question of why are we here? Where do we come from? Where do we go when we die? All of these things, I think, are ultimately on the table when you start talking about something as big as this. This is not just about, is that light in the sky a spaceship? There's so much more implications to something like this, and we just want to explore it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I personally, I've mentioned this on this show before, when it comes to abductions or experiencers, if I was experiencing what they are supposedly experiencing, I don't know if I could function in this world. I just don't know how I could possibly move on. Like that, if something like that was happening at night, how would I ever even want to go to work the next day or function with family or anything like that? How do these people do it? If this is really happening, I mean, what some thoughts on that, Jack?
Well, I think sure. It depends on the individual, but a lot of them don't function very well, and they really, in most cases, they're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. just like as someone who would come back from the Gulf War mm-hmm. or Afghanistan. It's the same. It's a traumatic, stressful experiences that they're having, and they are feeling that psychologically. Many of them, though, what tends to happen with people is the more time that goes by, they start to accept it. And they put it in a particular box. And some people might say, well, I was destined to be part of this. And maybe I agreed to do this in a prior lifetime. Wow. Or, you know, mm-hmm. there's somehow that's my purpose and I'm helping humanity. Somehow I'm helping humanity. And you know, but many people, they suffer and they don't. And especially at first, they're a mess. They don't go to work. Relationships are destroyed. They lose their jobs. We had one particular person in this film, Rob Fullington, who really struggled mightily. And he was dealing with physical issues as a result of this, psychological issues as a result of this. And he basically was almost indigent, pretty much. I mean, he had lost everything. And then they start to get back on their feet slowly but surely. But, you know, this was posed the other night, and John and I were talking about this. You know, how many people that have had these experiences, and we'll never know this, but how many may have committed suicide?
That was actually on my mind, but I was almost afraid to ask.
It's a tough subject, yeah. But like, I guarantee you that there are a certain number of these experiencers who just can't live with it.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I would emphasize too, is that when you're making a film like this, at the end of the day, you're showing an hour and 45 minutes. So we're not showing everything that we captured. Would be impossible to do that, although we are going to be featuring some of the interviews and a great portion of the interviews on a Patreon account, which we're building out. Some of these things will be available for anybody who wants to do a deeper dive. We'll be able to see them by becoming a supporting member of our Patreon page, because we want to continue to tell these stories. And one of the ways that we can do that is to find a community that supports the storytelling and the path that we're taking, which is more of a humanistic approach as opposed to just evidence or conspiracy theory. But the point that I want to make is that when you sit down with somebody for 7-8 hours to do an interview and they break down in tears and have to walk away from the camera, you know, several times because it's too intense to tell their story, There's a level of compassion that you have to have towards people who are doing this. They're feeling in the moment that I'm sharing something that is potentially could go out to the world to see. And I consider what Geraldine, Rob, and April in particular did was brave, because they're sharing a story that in a week from today, when it goes out for the masses to see, their stories are no longer their own stories. They're going to become part of the ufology story in a grand way. So what we just want to do is encourage people to step back before you're quick to judge and say, what if I spent a week with this person, or a day, or even an afternoon with them? What would I experience? And you would likely experience manic activity and depressed activity. You would see the highs and the lows in a very short amount of time, because every single person that we've interviewed who's had an experience shares the highs and the lows, and they're usually very excited one moment and very down the next, and it's difficult to watch sometimes. And that's one of the things we want to drive home, is that, you know, as corny as this might sound, experiences are people too. We should treat them with the same respect and compassion and empathy that we would with anybody else who's been going through something traumatic, because it is a traumatic experience for them.
Right. And I understand I've actually seen this in action out in Phoenix the last number of years. There's sort of a group therapy going on between them. They get together and basically help each other just by talking about it. Did you see any of that? Have you do people find that the people that you have interviewed, are any of them part of any type of situation like that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we saw when we were shooting the film, we shot some things that weren't included in the film, and one of them was bringing these people together so that they could talk about their personal experiences amongst people who've had the experiences, and Barbara Lamb and Yvonne Smith were there as well to kind of facilitate it, and they talked for about 3 hours. And there was this sense of understanding, a sense of community, but also a sense of support that I found my tribe, because, you know, there's people who have been telling their stories for 30, 40 years, and those people have become comfortable with that exposure. Other people have never told their story to anyone, and then they're asked to share their story in a group setting, and it's very difficult, very challenging. But one of the things we want to encourage with this film is that, you know, two things: for people to understand that those going through the experiences are having they're having trauma, and they need our empathy and compassion, but also to encourage the people who've had them to find the community. So we'll have, at the end of the film, there's a link to shown that is a link to a portal on our website that will allow people who have had an experience, if they're comfortable enough to do more research, they can start there. Because that's one of the things we've had since we started promoting this film, is several people have reached out to us and say, I have a story to tell, but I don't want to tell anybody, but I need to speak to someone. Can you help us?
Uh-huh.
So it's happened on numerous times. One time with a couple where the male had an experience and is just does not want to talk about it, but it's impacting the relationship. And the female was like, we need to do something to help this. I believe him, but he's struggling with sharing his story. So just imagine, extrapolate that out to relationships where people who have had that experience, what does that mean? What is that energy like, where you don't feel comfortable talking to somebody? So we're trying to encouraging that sense of community. And I think that once people find their tribe and realize that they're not alone, they find ways to better manage it. Like Jack had mentioned earlier, they find the box that best works for them on how to manage it. But it never goes away. I mean, there's a line in the film that Yvonne Smith says, is that whenever she screens somebody for a regression, she says to them is that, you know, once we open this door, we can't close it. Once the toothpaste is out of the toothpaste, it can't go back in. So you have to be prepared for what's to come. And the people who are brave enough to share those stories and have those regression experiences have a story to tell that we think is worthy of listening to.
Just a quick story about Yvonne. I was out in California, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I was near where she was at. I contacted her and said, hey, can I come into your office and we'll record a show? And she said, sure, fine. So I went in, the recording equipment, everything was working fine. I went and recorded there, did a show there. This was back when I was doing just the podcast. And I got home and I plugged it in, and it was really weird. It was not her and I. It was like someone like humming, and almost sounded like a Native American chant. So I called her and I said, you're not going to believe this, but the recording, I even checked the recording when I was in her office, was working fine. I said, there's something really going on. She said, it's not the first time. She had other things happen in her office like that, which was totally bizarre. I know I'm going off the deep end here, but I wanted to talk to you. We're going to be going to a break in about 5 minutes or so, but I have a friend in Sweden who's been on the show a number of times, Klas Fahn, and he is basically in charge of, or he was a past president of their UFO group over there. It's kind of like a MUFON. Takes in a lot of UFO cases, very interesting. And there's no ridicule. And there's no ridicule in Sweden as far as he's concerned. People take the subject really seriously. He has a huge library he's in charge of. So I asked him about abductions. I said, what's going on there and about abductions? He said, I might get one case a year. Now, my question is, do you think that it's a regional situation? You mentioned earlier that people are abducted all over the world, but do you think there's possibly a regional type situation? Because look at America, you know, I mean, so many people here are saying something's going on.
That's hard to say. I mean, you know, you have population differences. You know, we have a much larger population than Sweden. But it could, you know, you could talk about, well, where, you know, again, now we're getting into, we could talk about underground bases and where, you know, where these things are occurring. And, you know, it's hard to, and maybe there is a military component to it. And if that's the case, then the U.S. has a much larger military presence than Sweden does. Mm-hmm. So, but there's so many variables to that. That's actually really surprising that he said only one a year. Wow.
Yeah, but the one
– I think part of it too is that there is this is there a comfort level in sharing those stories?
Well, so I asked him about that, and he said that it's very – they're very comfortable talking about that type of situation. Okay. But I will tell you that the one abduction story he told me was a doozy, and it was a police officer involved in everything. His wife lifted right off the bed. He saw the whole thing and couldn't move, and it was really a crazy story. So he's not opposed to it, and as far as he knows, no one else is opposed to it there. So I just thought that was interesting.
And I think it's in situations like that too, it's a encouraging conversation and talking about it and sharing it in a way where people feel like it is a, I think there's a pride thing, there is a integrity, and some people are will choose not to tell their story because they know that nothing good is going to come of it. At least that would be the majority of the people, you know, would say. Jack mentioned earlier about Rob. Rob's had experiences that he's still grappling with. He's still struggling with how he fits into everything that he's learned and everything that he's been exposed to. And, you know, he told us, he goes, I sometimes feel more I think I would feel more comfortable off planet than on. Hmm. He said, but I didn't feel that way 7-8 years ago or 10 years ago when he had his first experience in 2009. So he said that, you know, everything has changed for him. And then you have somebody like Geraldine, who was a successful businesswoman. She was engaged to get married. She had had an abduction scenario that she recalled in 2013, and it kept gnawing at her. But her fiance at the time said, this is something that you don't want to make present to your family, the community at large. Your kids will have to deal with you telling this story. So she buried it. But she said it kept gnawing at her. She had some other things that happened too, and she went and had two regressions. And after the one regression, she broke off the relationship, and after the other regression, within a month of each other, she quit her six-figure-a-year job and said, I need to help people who've gone through what I've gone through. And she's dedicated her life to making a difference. So there's somebody who's had an experience and has turned it into something positive by trying to help in the best way she knows how.
Wow, that is really interesting. I bet the number one question that an experiencer has is why? Why is this happening? Maybe why is it happening to me, or just plain why? What did you, we only got about a minute to break. I don't know if either one of you want to tackle that.
Yeah, they do ask that. And a lot of times they don't get the answer, but they always like, why me? Of everyone on this planet, like, why am I going through this? And it's almost like you're going through all those phases of grief. You know, you have the anger, you have the fear and the anger, and all these emotions are there for these people. To answer that question as to the possibilities of why would take longer than the time we have right now. But that is something we could talk about after the break.
Sure.
But yeah.
You know, if there are so many people being, you know, having this experience, it just seems like you talked earlier, there's, you know, there's no real empirical evidence that this is happening. And, you know, I wonder, is there never going to be? I mean, is there not going to be someone nearby with a cell phone camera that's going to snap a picture of someone floating out a window, or, you know, I mean,
it's not all... blurry.
What's that?
It's not blurry.
Yeah, that's not blurry. Yeah. So anyway, we're right at our break. So we're going to head into that break. All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to the free part of our show. The show continues into hour two, and we do get a number of phone calls. It's very interesting. I think you'd really enjoy it. All you have to do to listen to the full shows and the archives of all of our shows is to go over to podcastufo.com and you can support the show through either Patreon or our regular subscription service of $2 or more per month. There's also yearly payments. You can go that route as well. And anyway, I want to thank everyone for listening. We'll be back next week with Marion Rudick. He's a NASA scientist. He's going to be talking about UFOs. It should be a great show. All right, everyone. So remember to keep your eyes to the sky.